From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in San Francisco in the Glen Park area.
Sunset, Portola Valley.
I currently reside in Nob Hill.
West Portal.
I live in Russian Hill.
Coming up, we meet a senior citizen living with HIV.
I myself am grateful that I have what I have to help me survive.
Then we'll get up to date on the disease with an advisor to the president.
HIV really lives at the intersection and shines a spotlight on so many different ways in which people are marginalized.
And two caregivers for clients with AIDS reflect on their work.
The biggest thing that bridges the gap is my queer identity, and that's one thing that I have in common with lots of clients.
Living and sharing today on Cross Currents. We've come a long way since HIV first emerged in the 1980s, a time people feared the new unknown, a time of nonstop PSAs on television like these.
Hi, I'm Johnny Depp of 21 Jump Street. Listen, AIDS is very serious and very dangerous. Get involved in your community. Learn all you can. Thank you.
How much do you know about AIDS? Someone can have the AIDS virus for a long time and not even know it.
If you have sex, have just one safe partner, or always use condoms. Always.
Okay, that was then. Over the past 30 years, research helped us understand the virus. Treatments have improved. So HIV is no longer viewed as a death sentence. And it's evident here in San Francisco, where the majority of people living with HIV and AIDS are now aged 50 or over. But with age come other concerns, like access to affordable housing and healthcare, mental health issues, and isolation. KALW's Jasmine Lopez introduces us to one HIV-positive senior who considers himself one of the lucky ones.
Hello.
Hi, Joe.
Jasmine.
Yes, I'm here.
Let me see if I can press this.
Joe Childress lives in a new brick building in the South Park neighborhood of San Francisco.
Coming up.
If there are three things Childress loves in this world, it's art, silent film, and his dog, Rupert.
This is the apartment I live in. Look, this is Rupert. I hope you're not afraid of dogs. He's very, very friendly.
Hi.
Childress was diagnosed with HIV in 1987. He didn't expect to survive, but he did. So that means managing his illness and everything that goes along with it. Take his living situation, for example. After years of struggling to find a safe and affordable place to live, he heard about the AIDS Housing Alliance, a nonprofit that offers housing services to people living with HIV. They helped him enroll in a housing lottery out of the mayor's office, and he won. Monthly rent in this building is usually in the $3,000 to $4,000 range, but because he qualified for Section 8, Childress pays just $125 a month for his apartment. But Childress was one of the lucky ones. Usually, low-income HIV-positive seniors struggle to find affordable housing. They often have a fixed income, and some fear that their landlords would discriminate against them for having a chronic illness.
If you lose your housing, you know, first of all, you lose your home where you might have been for 30 years.
Dr. Patrick Arbor works with the Institute on Aging.
And then to try to figure out how do you find a new place that is affordable is really hard. And so you have to look at the East Bay or, you know, Vallejo. But then you lose your network of support.
Arbor says life as a low-income senior with HIV can feel like a series of trade-offs. Do I stay near my friends or move to find more affordable housing? This struggle is most obvious when it comes to expensive medications.
Okay, I usually take my medications with milk.
Like most people with HIV, Joe Childress has dozens of pills to take every morning and every night.
I take, I can't pronounce it, but it's for my allergies. One pill a day, $49, I think, a month. Effexor XR, two capsules a day, probably $190 maybe a month, dollars. And
the average number of medications that an older person takes ranges from 8 to 12 prescriptions per year. And when you think that one of those prescriptions might cost $450 a month, and you're taking six or seven, you can see how quickly that adds up.
There is another psychotropic medication, Lamotrigine, 200 milligrams, that I take two of once a day. 90 maybe a month, dollars. See, I'll take the Isentris, which is part of my HIV medication, twice a day, 60 tablets. $1,800 or $1,900 a month.
And so when we are making people choose between kind of quality of life and their medications, we're asking them to make a really difficult decision.
Reitaz,
Norvir,
Epsicon,
Phenofibrate.
Childress estimates that his medications cost at least $4,000 a month. But again, he's fortunate. Most of them are covered under Medi-Cal. Dr. Patrick Arbour says many seniors end up paying for their meds out of pocket because they have trouble navigating the system.
Rupert, you're going to sing a song? You say the song I made up for you, The Three Little Poodles?
For all the luck Childress has had in getting housing and financial help, he's still struggling with feeling alone. He's lost many friends to AIDS over the years.
This was like in 1982 or so, and a friend would say, well, you know, I don't feel well, I don't have a doctor, and we'll go here, go to mine, and then 3 weeks later he died. I have, for some reason, not been able to forget them. I'm that type of person.
And this is a common topic at Joe's weekly support group.
So it's really good to see everybody. Welcome.
That's Scott Heitsuka. He's a program coordinator at Open House SF, a nonprofit that helps LGBT seniors in San Francisco with their housing and mental health. There, Heitsuka facilitates a meetup for HIV-positive men over the age of 50.
Where do we want to start? Anybody want to start?
I'm going to run down.
The room feels safe, intimate. Most of these men have known each other for years. I joined them for a session right before the holidays, and it was an especially tough time for some of them. Richard is one of the first to speak up.
Probably about 15 or 20 years ago when my partner died, and then my best friend died, and 100 other friends died of varying degrees, I got rid of every Christmas ornament. I used to have a huge collection and a huge gatherings of friends, and I stopped doing that.
Heitsuka's a facilitator, but he's lived through similar challenges. He lost his partner of 17 years to AIDS in 2006.
All of these group members have experienced a tremendous amount of loss. They have lived in San Francisco, some of them since the late 60s, early 70s. When the HIV epidemic hit and started here in San Francisco, it wiped out a whole community, if not a generation, of men.
And now, due to aging, they continue to lose friends and members of their chosen family. So Heitsuka says groups like these help HIV-positive seniors stay connected to a community. It's one of the many things Joe Childress says he's lucky to have.
I myself am grateful that I have what I have to help me survive. I'm heartbroken that people that need the same or similar conditions do not have it.
He says his hope is that more people will be able to count on the services that have helped him, and that one day, his story will be commonplace. For Cross Currents, I'm Jasmine Lopez.
To learn more about Open House SF or any of the other resources you just heard about, go to kalw.org, click on Cross Currents. And if you have resources you can share with us, do it on Facebook. We are KALW. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Back when HIV was first diagnosed in San Francisco, it hit the gay male population hard. Since that time, the virus has spread to more diverse communities. Nana Khanna is the executive director for Positive Women's Network, which represents more than 2,500 HIV-positive women. In 2010, she was appointed to President Obama's Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS. Khanna herself was diagnosed with HIV in 2002, as she told KALW's Ben Trefney.
You know, when I was diagnosed, it was in November of 2002, and one of the reasons it was so shocking and surprising was because I had actually tried to get tested twice before and had been told both times that I didn't need a test. And what I didn't know at the time, but kind of, you know, learned later through meeting other women living with HIV, is that this is really not an uncommon situation for women to face, that, you know, a lot of times women are discouraged from testing or not seen as being at risk. And so frequently are tested, you know, late into their diagnosis or once they get sick or because they're pregnant or, you know, kind of going through the healthcare system for some other reason and getting lab tests done.
In 2002, did you see this as something that was going to be beatable?
I saw it as something that it was definitely life-changing. It was totally transformative. I had no idea what to do with this information. It was the last thing I expected to hear. I couldn't figure out how to fit it into my life, so I sort of compartmentalized it and went about the rest of my life. So I really didn't deal with it for the first couple of years after my diagnosis. I was busy doing other things.
Did your body degrade? I mean, did you see symptoms?
Not really. I was pretty healthy. I was always pretty healthy, but I was working really hard on the election in 2004.
Your body might have degraded just from that,
yeah,
because I was sleeping.
Yeah, I definitely saw some things going on with my body that were, you know, that I kind of just attributed mostly to stress and probably compromised immune function. I wasn't motivated to go to the doctor right away because of this whole set of concerns that I had about health insurance access and being excluded and potential employment restrictions or things like that. But I was motivated because my boyfriend at the time and I saw this information come out about the fact that I might actually be able to be a less risky partner. And, you know, so that was more motivating to me at the time. And it was certainly motivating as part of my relationship. And I think it's important to understand that a lot of times people make decisions about medical care in the context of our families, our communities, our relationships.
So when HIV began to strike American communities, it began primarily in white, middle-class, gay communities. Who gets HIV now? Like, how has that changed?
The demographics of the epidemic have changed a lot. It has become increasingly racialized, increasingly feminized, increasingly impoverished. So now we see that a disproportionate number of infections are happening among young men who have sex with men of color, and also among women of color, and across, you know, sort of both sets of those populations, disproportionately in communities that are poor and have less access to resources and less access to information.
Why is it in more marginalized communities?
If you just think about the way that HIV is transmitted, so HIV is, it's much less likely that HIV is going to be transmitted if your viral load is suppressed, okay? It's basically not something that you're going to pass on to your
sexual partner.
And
when you say viral
load,
do you mean that
the amount of HIV in your bloodstream,
okay?
The amount of HIV virus that shows up in your bloodstream, in your seminal fluids, in your vaginal fluids, in breast milk. Those are the four fluids that transmit HIV. So when I say viral load is suppressed, I basically mean that it's at levels where it's not detectable in most of those fluids. So the likelihood that you can transmit it is very low. So once you get to a community where the viral load is higher because there's less access to healthcare, because there's less frequent testing, or because there are restrictions on federally funded and publicly funded programs so that you don't face with private health insurance. So, for example, a private health insurance company might give you a 60-day or a 90-day supply of your medication. a state-funded program might require you to get a 30-day supply at a time and will only fill it, you know, 2 days before it's going to expire. So if you can't make it to the pharmacy at that time, or you're out of town, or your grandmother's sick and you need to help her and you just couldn't go to the pharmacy, or your kid is sick or you need to take them to school, you're more likely to miss your doses and less likely to have a suppressed viral load. So, you know, there are many ways in which people who are facing more barriers to healthcare and to access and less financial security are more at risk for having an unsuppressed viral load.
That is Nana Khanna. She is executive director of the Positive Women's Network, a national membership body of HIV-positive women grounded in gender equity and human rights. So you're on the President's Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS and have been since 2010. How do you see this president in dealing with this? Do you think that he's been doing things that you've liked, and what would you like to see him do?
So President Obama has taken some major steps forward in our in addressing the domestic HIV epidemic. For the first time ever, we have a U.S. national HIV/AIDS strategy, which was released in July of 2010, which is our first ever coordinated domestic plan to address the epidemic. You know, this is almost 30 years into the epidemic that we had the first ever coordinated domestic plan released. Although the U.S. has required other countries to have plans in order to get our funding for years. You know, that was another major step forward by the president. And then, of course, the Affordable Care Act, you know, can't be taken out of this equation. It has huge implications for people living with HIV. It has huge implications for people at risk for HIV by including specific guidelines around regular HIV screening and making sure that those will be reimbursable, you know, so that insurance companies are required to cover that. So these are major steps forward in terms of enhancing the health of people living with and at risk for HIV.
What should people know about HIV today?
HIV is not a death sentence anymore. It's something that you can live with, and it's something that you can live not just survive with, but live a long, healthy, dignified, high-quality life.
You seem awfully healthy.
I'm pretty healthy. And that means that there are things that need to change. Stigma is a huge problem. It is, you know, possibly even a bigger problem than it was in the early days of the epidemic. And there have been national surveys that show that the numbers of people in the U.S. who are uncomfortable with an HIV-positive person caring for their child or preparing food for them are higher today than they were in the 90s. And that's really a huge problem. It shows a lack of basic information, and it reflects, I think, very poorly on our system of sex education and health education that we have in this country.
Nana Khanna serves on President Obama's Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS. She spoke with KALW's Ben Trefney. You can find more information about Khanna's work at kalw.org. Click on Cross Currents. And you can hear a longer conversation between Nana Khanna and KALW's Rose Aguilar. Go to kalw.org and click on Your Call. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. And now it's time for your stories. This is San Francisco StoryCorps. It takes all kinds of people to help support those with HIV. Friends and coworkers Adrian Elias and Eric Sutter come from very different backgrounds, but they both feel passionate about their work at Shanti, a San Francisco nonprofit dedicated to enhancing the lives of people with HIV and other life-threatening illnesses. They sat down at the StoryCorps booth at the Contemporary Jewish Museum in San Francisco and talked about how their similarities and differences with their clients help them in their work.
So, I thought a good place for us to start talking would just be maybe for you to tell me a bit about how you ended up in the place that you are with regard to work.
Okay. Well, when I first moved to the city, I was homeless, and I was a part of this organization called Larkin, and they set youth up with internships at different agencies. So when I signed up for it, I didn't know where I was going to be placed, and when they told me about Shanti, I didn't know what it was, and I didn't know, when I learned that it was going to be in HIV services, I didn't really know anything about HIV. I guess the more I learned about HIV, the more I realized how important it is, the work that I was doing, and how important it is for, like, my community.
How do you go about bridging the gap between you and the client? And, like, you know, you have such separate realities. I mean, in some cases, the client's going to sleep outside at night and you're going home to your house where you have, like, a bed and all your stuff and, you know, you don't have to worry about being robbed, you know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, what do you think, or, like, what do you do to kind of, like, bridge that gap? And are you conscious of that?
I'm definitely conscious of that. And I think that the hardest thing about it is a lot of the things that our clients go through, and not all of them, but a good number of them, I have been through before in my past. The biggest thing that bridges the gap is, like, my queer identity. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that I have in common with lots of clients, not mm-hmm. all. But they don't have to tell me, like, what it means to be trans or whatever. So I'm wondering how you bridge the gap with clients.
Honestly, like, I think the way that I bridge the gap is just by being totally honest with clients. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't... I'm straight, I'm white, I'm middle class. Like, I have... on paper, like, almost nothing in common with most of our clients, I guess. And being a person who, like, gets stuff done for them is, you know, ultimately what I think what bridges the gap. And I think also maybe just being aware of, like, the fact that maybe that gap is never going to be bridged. You know yeah. what I mean? Like, how am I going to know what it's like to be a trans woman? There's no way that I can, you know... Mm-hmm. There's no way that I can really get a handle on that or really grasp that.
Yeah.
And so just respecting someone for who they are and just being like, if this is what you want to do, like, that's totally cool. One of the major connections that we make with a lot of our clients is so many people, like, don't even acknowledge, like, their humanity, you know? And so being able to provide that to someone, I think, is, you know, like, a gift not only for them, but, like, also for you, mm-hmm. where you're just like, well, this is awesome that, like, I can, you know, I can do what other people aren't.
Learn more about the Shanti Project at klw.org. Click on Cross Currents. And that's all for today's Cross Currents. The team includes David Boyer, Jeremy Dalmas, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Liz Pfeffer, Stephen Short, and Mary Willis. Today's show was produced by Audrey Dilling and engineered by Seth Samuel. Our senior producer is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.